Hello and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan US Centre here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, Managing Editor of the Phelan US Centre's blog on US politics and policy, USAP. With growing questions about the United States' trade relationship with China in crucial sectors such as semiconductors, the role of industrial policy, especially in relation to Joe Biden's presidential administration, is becoming more and more important. To find out more about US industrial policy, in July 2024, I spoke to Nathan Lane, Associate Professor in Economics at Oxford University and a Tutorial Fellow at Merton College, Oxford. He is co-founder of the Industrial Policy Group, which is based at the University of Oxford. Professor Lane's research interests cover the intersection of political economy, industrial development, comparative historical development, and big data. We spoke about industrial policy in the US and its history, including recent policies from the Biden administration, like the Inflation Reduction Act and the CHIPS Act. We also talked about how US industrial policy might change depending on who wins the 2024 presidential election. Thank you so much for joining us on the Ballpark this afternoon. It's great to be able to speak to you. Could you just start out by telling us a bit about your academic background and research interests?
So I have a PhD in economics and I am an economist. I am an associate professor here at the University of Oxford in the Department of Economics. And I run a little research group, which is an international research group called the Industrial Policy Group. My research really focuses on economic development, long-run growth, also medium-run growth, and the political economy of both those things. And I like to say, and my colleagues like to say, we study how states impact economic change and economic transformation and the interaction between markets and politics therein.
So much of your work focuses on industrial policy. Could you just give a quick overview of what the term means for our listeners who may not be so familiar with the idea of industrial policy? Thank you.
Yeah, it's a term that a lot of people, there's a lot of ambiguity around it. It's used in really sloppy ways, and people mean different things by it, often when it's used, especially in public discussions and editorials and things like that. I think a discipline principle definition of industrial policy relates to kind of what I said before. It's purposeful, intentional state action that's meant to change what economies do, shifting the composition of economic activity in a domestic economy. So you're trying to change what's occurring. You're trying to change the nature with some specificity, what types of economic activity is being pursued, more or less in the long run.
Fantastic. And could you maybe give an example that people might be familiar with of recent industrial policy in the US or the UK?
I could also give a kind of canonical example that's often used. Let's go far back in history, is things like infant industry policy, using tariffs to support and incubate a new industry such as steel. You know, that's a very kind of old view that is industrial policy. But I think of, to answer your question, we can think of more contemporary industrial policies, things like DARPA, things that invest in projects and policies that invest in new technologies. I think that has a very industrial policy flavor and is many times industrial policy. Local content requirements have an industrial policy flavor, often are meant to promote certain domestic industries by saying that, hey, government should use bolts from Atlanta, you know, things like that. And so in government procurement, things of that nature. The list can go on. A lot of leveling up, a lot of place-based policies we can think of as industrial policies. You're trying to change the spatial allocation of economic activity and where it's occurring. I think around Europe and the US, a lot of trade policy often has Trump just planned to raise tariffs on EVs, on Chinese EVs specifically, I should say. It has a political dimension, but it also has an industrial policy dimension to it. The worry is that there's going to be dumping on the U.S. market, and you want to incubate electric vehicle production in the U.S. from these forces in order for it to have a chance to grow and succeed. I think those are some kind of very salient examples historically and in contemporary times, just to be concrete about things.
Thank you. And it's interesting you mentioned that some policies have a political kind of political reasoning behind them. Is industrial policy just about increasing jobs, increasing welfare, or is there often a political dimension as well, or indeed other dimensions to industrial policy? I'm sort of trying to get at the reasons why do governments do this?
Yeah, you can think of many reasons why, right? I mean, politicians and those in government, they're not economists. So often their objectives might be very different than what, you know, technocrats or us with propeller hats kind of desire and think about optimal policy and measuring economic welfare, which, of course, I think is very, very important. But often you think of Xi Jinping in China. I think in promoting the domestic shipbuilding industry, which is a kind of very well-studied case of industrial policy, they had a kind of a big push of sorts to create a strategic industry in steel shipbuilding. Was it economically efficient? Probably not. Did it serve a large political goal? Absolutely. You know, that to become a global leader in a new industry that's fairly important strategically, if you want a navy and if you want kind of more hegemony, these things are very, very important. And I think it's a good question because there's often multiple objectives when it comes to industrial policy. There often are like kind of correlated. Complementary objectives, growth and kind of national strategic aims, and both can be very, very intertwined. But also it means that the political dimensions can seem a bit strange to people just looking through, just looking at policies through only an economic lens.
We've talked a bit about why governments implement industrial policy. So is industrial policy implemented by governments in the way that it's designed, or do other factors such as politics get in the way?
Yes and yes, right? Right. It's like the degree to which, and it varies all over the world, but again, let me go back to what I was saying before, if that's okay. If you think about we as economists and a lot of people who think a lot about wonky policy and technocratic policy, which is the right impulse, we think of industrial policy as usually in terms of what's the most efficient thing, what would a policy look like if it were set by, God forbid, an economist? What would be, you know, the optimal design of a tax rate or a subsidy scheme, something like that? But in actuality, right, that's not how things are pursued. You know, the industrial policy is the purview of the state and is the purview of politics. It's the choices are made by politicians. The design is then can be very politicized sometimes. In some places, if we're lucky enough, the design can be delegated to members of the state and members of the civil service who are insulated from political forces and can be somewhat technocratic. But I think it's safe to say that because, you know, this is where the rubber hits the road, this is where policy is kind of innately political. In very few places, I think it's safe to say in most places, industrial policy isn't done by some absolutely autonomous agency. It's something that is kind of bargained through and discussed, often designed, sometimes implemented by political bodies, political entities, with the help and combination of the kind of various levers of the state, the various bureaucracies and administrative institutions of the state. I mean, it often gets lost to people. You know, people might look at it, gets to kind of the question you asked earlier. People think about, you know, they look at a policy and they're like, well, that industrial policy looks insane. Well, it's a product of a very messy political process, and it's implemented by states that don't always invest in the capacity to implement them. And so it's subject to what we call, what my colleagues and I call, political constraints and state capacity constraints. It's chosen by politicians and ultimately implemented by what states have and the bodies that states have.
Thank you. I think it's a really interesting dynamic you're talking about in terms of the if I understand this correctly, those who are designing it are often not those who are implementing it. Are there any examples, especially thinking maybe in a U.S. state context, we have this federal government, which will set industrial policy generally for the country as a whole, which is 300 million plus a million people, 50 states. Are there any examples where there's maybe a political difference between Washington, D.C. and a state where the state sort of says, actually, we don't want this or we want something different? Is there anything, are there any examples of that where that you have a real division, a real conflict?
Yeah. So in the state, in the U.S., I'd have to think about it, but in the U.S., a lot of industrial policy that often is latent and we don't think about a lot is conducted through place-based policy. That is stuff that's very geographically targeted and trying to develop and trying to help or produce positive outcomes in kind of left behind communities, which I think would be near and dear to many people in the UK. It's often something that's a policy ambition that's front of mind here. And so in pursuing a lot of place-based policies, there's kind of this pipeline of different agencies from federal to local level to local development communities to implement this stuff. And there can definitely be differences in design, differences in implementation that diverge from kind of a general vision that's being cast at the top, that's being cast by the whatever federal plan people are following. And so there can be discrepancy there. I think there's, with different policies, there's a lot of variation in the degree to which the bodies pursuing and implementing industrial policy have power to design the policy. So there's a lot of variation that mostly political scientists, people in the weeds of kind of public management, public administration studies, look at this. And there's a great example from Jonas Nahm, who actually works in the Biden administration now. I think it's probably his last week. Who's at Johns Hopkins University, who looks at that variation across different bodies and looks at some nice examples within California, where certain bodies implementing green industrial policies in the state of California were given power to design more efficient, kind of better informed policies because an agency, as opposed to congressional staff members, has deep expertise, often in a market or in a particular policy domain. They have people who are there for a long time who have kind of institutional knowledge of how things work, rather than you're not relying on a team of staffers in a congressional office who are 22. And so his research and other comparative political science research kind of marshals some interesting case studies that look at, well, the power of empowering local institutions, or kind of, I shouldn't say local institutions per se, but empowering certain administrative bodies with the authority to design stuff.
So how should we think about industrial policy in the historical American context? How have succeeding American governments used industrial policy? And why has it gone in and out of favor?
Yeah. So I think, oddly enough, so the U.S. has definitely not always been associated with industrial policy. But I think the kind of big picture early thinking of industrial policy comes from the U.S. and the nascent U.S. state. People like Alexander Hamilton famously were some of the first people trying to articulate a national vision for industrial policy in a series of essays he wrote in his early political career. And so it definitely has a long history in the U.S., but of course we think of the U.S. as a very laissez-faire capitalist place. And I should say, too, the industrial policy is definitely compatible with capitalism and is used by capitalist economies and has often innately been used by capitalist economies. It predates socialism and kind of state planning and things like that. And so in the U.S., it's ebbed and flowed, right? You have important periods in the U.S. during the New Deal, actually before the New Deal, even by the Hoover administration, where the American government pursued very robust industrial policies to a certain degree. Of course, the U.S. has always been very, very kind of market-oriented. So the depth of these policies will look much different from the way we envisioned them in, say, historical Prussia or during the East Asian miracle. But to think of why it fell out of favor, it really fell out of favor with the kind of ascent of, and I don't mean this term in a pejorative way, the kind of rise of the Washington Consensus in neoliberalism. Really, the idea that the state should get out of the way, should be minimalist. A lot of that thinking, which emerged in the late 70s and really took hold in, of course, the 80s and beyond, with the alongside the rise of globalization, really made industrial policy and constrained a lot of the levers of industrial policy, was really antagonistic to the idea of industrial policy. And industrial policy, the vision of these things was really to minimize the role of industrial policy in a lot of cases. So big multilateral institutions that emerged within the EU, of course, emerged internationally after World War II, really worked to constrain a lot of the impulses and a lot of the mechanisms of industrial policy, probably for good reason in many cases. And so the US was really, really at the vanguard of that in kind of not pursuing industrial policy in the robust way that they had done under New Deal Democrats and in the kind of, for lack of a better word, kind of more statist era of economic policymaking in the US. But that isn't to say industrial policy, it fell out of favor. It was something that was very much constrained, but it never went away. We often called it different things. And we often, it often kind of was left humming along in kind of individual pockets of the government. Things like DARPA. Reagan pursued industrial policy in some very kind of interesting ways, in kind of some subaltern ways that aren't always talked about. The Department of Defense pursues industrial policy. Of course, I just mentioned DARPA, but there's a lot of defense and strategic-related industrial policies that not only didn't go away, were probably kind of ramped up in this kind of neoliberal era of American politics. But of course, industrial policy has reemerged and kind of returned, especially post-COVID. Like it's just become super, super salient and something that isn't taboo to talk about overtly anymore. And that too is a product of changes in US political economy.
Thank you. I think the example of DARPA you've mentioned a couple of times is a really interesting one, because it sort of seems to me that industrial policy, even if it's humming along in the background, can really inform most of what society does in the world, or really kind of act as kind of a bedrock. Like we wouldn't be having this conversation but for DARPA, which helped to create the internet, and things like GPS technology. And I guess just what I'm sort of thinking about is how crucial is industrial policy to society as we know it, and kind of that, even if it is humming in the background.
I think it's really, and many economists do this, and I probably do it too. We kind of present this fiction as if all this stuff just came out of thin air, and a lot of the things around us are just products of completely decentralized, unintentional forces and kind of, the individual competitive action of markets. And, maybe that's true to some extent, but it's hard to think of very principal components of the world and their existence without industrial policies. We study semiconductors, and reading the history of semiconductors, of course, which is everything, it's hard to even think about. When we started studying that market, it was hard for us as economists to even think about the market absent and abstract away the state. Because you look at it, it's like the state is so integral everywhere this stuff is done. It's hard to find instances of nascent semiconductor sectors where the state didn't play a role in some shape or form, often a substantial role. I think it's a perceptive question, because kind of when you look beneath the surface at a lot of things in our everyday life, it's often the product of weird industrial policies that have been lurking in the background, or some kind of weird R&D, or some kind of public funding of innovative research, at least coming from a university somewhere. So it's really hard to abstract away from that stuff when you kind of peel the onion and look into the history of various things we take for granted in our daily life.
So how has U.S. industrial policy been influenced in recent years by the U.S.'s relationship with China and maybe even China's own industrial policy?
So I think it's both. It's been influenced without a doubt by both, very much informed by both. China has played a massive role in the return of industrial policy globally and surely within the U.S. You see inklings of that before COVID in the Trump trade wars, which it's hard to think of that, a lot of that as industrial policy, because a lot of it's so overtly political. The objectives are kind of, it's very discordant, right? But you can see already that there is a worry and there is a political demand for a response to what's happening in China. And what's happening in China is industrial policy. Industrial policy has been pursued. It's part of the fabric of a lot of what China does economically. Market forces are for sure, but they have marshaled industrial policy in very, very important ways. And as they've become, again, more hegemonic, and as there has been more strategic competition with the U.S., there's been a realization within the U.S. and a bipartisan realization that there needs to be a response, whether that's both politically, but also in terms of what manufacturing might be threatened if things escalate, or if there is a supply chain meltdown, such as what occurred during COVID. And so that's all to say, I think China has played a massive role in informing the political and economic scope, going back to what you said before, with the return of industrial policy in the U.S. And in particular, politically, it's I think, allowed a bipartisan consensus to be pursued around industrial policy in the U.S. And it's also informed, of course, EU industrial policy a lot.
So many politicians and analysts in the EU and the U.S. have talked about de-risking their economies, particularly among certain sectors like semiconductors. Can you just really quickly talk about what de-risking means and whether or not it has a meaningful difference to industrial policy? Thank you.
Yeah, I think of it as an idea that, again, it kind of emerged, especially in EU policy discourse, quickly then in U.S. discourse. And I'd say it's used by policymakers and politicians usually as a way as an alternative to talking about decoupling, right? We don't want to completely be autarkic or completely sever our economic links, of which there's beneficial economic links with the rest of the world, or in particular China. But is it particularly smart to have big important sectors or product manufacturing concentrated there in the case that something happens, whatever that something may be? And so de-risking was a way to characterize the geopolitics and economics of that. And so I think it's safe to say the industrial policy is kind of an articulation of de-risking often. So these are definitely intertwined ideas. Actually, also people use that in all sorts of ways too, some of which can get pretty wacky within academia. But I suspect you mean it in the kind of very conventional, like in the sane kind of policy facing way that we don't want to expose ourselves to the potential geopolitical risk of having all our eggs in one basket.
The Biden administration has been focusing a lot on industrial policy in recent years, notably the CHIPS Act and the Inflation Reduction Act. How effective would you say these policies have been?
Yeah, that's the big question. And I think it's one thing I want to say too, is that people and economic commentators and academic economists are usually really too early in their evaluation of economic or of industrial policies. And so these policies, especially if you think of it, we'll go back to semiconductor manufacturing. Semiconductor manufacturing, it's a lot. I mean, we're talking about building a fab in Arizona, fabrication plant. It takes a long time to do that. I mean, we're making very, very long run investments, and the contribution to growth that we hope will eventually occur, or the change to national comparative advantage, these are long run things. So we have to think in the long run usually. But I guess to your question, it's been interesting in how efficacious they have been, just kind of raw numbers. And in particular, I think in terms of crowding in investment, a lot of these tax credits associated with these kind of two pillars of what people call Bidenomics. I think it's safe to say, using Treasury data, data from the Treasury Department, it's been pretty successful in marshaling investment and not replacing or crowding out investment, which was the initial fear, but actually spurring a lot of new investment in key kind of renewable sectors and in kind of semiconductor and adjacent industries there. And moreover, so you've seen a massive growth in kind of manufacturing construction, a pretty large growth in that. Since these policies have been deployed and eventually implemented, after you got through some of the initial teething projects of deploying a giant industrial policy like this, which took some learning because America was kind of out of practice of doing this big, large-scale industrial policy stuff. And so once money started flowing and things started kind of binding, you definitely saw and are seeing, even this like quarter two, where we are 2024, it really increases in investment in these sectors, which I think surprised some of us who were a bit pessimistic about what might happen. Because there's always a worry that, oh, maybe this is lending that would have all, you know, maybe this is inspiring investment that would have occurred even in the absence of these policies. But we see that investment going on. We see the contribution of manufacturing construction to GDP increasing in relationship to the IRA. You do see jobs in kind of electrical generation and renewables increasing in non-trivial numbers already, particularly in solar, but also in wind and things, I think, hydropower, things of that sort. And so you do see a lot of very, very interesting things happening. Of course, you're ultimately meant to promote growth and promote structural transformation. That's to be seen. But the intermediate stuff that we should be seeing is occurring. And that's kind of where interesting stuff is happening. And also, too, going back to place-based policy, there's multiple objectives of this thing. Some of these objectives are to build stuff in disadvantaged places. And you do see things like green investment going to places, especially if green investment related to the IRA, I should say, going to places that are relatively backwards, where incomes are low, household median income is low. And you do see that actually happening, which is pretty heartening.
Thank you. And if I may ask just a sort of a sidebar question, and at the potential risk of evaluating those programs too early, the United States seems to have much more robust economic growth in the last sort of year or so, despite high inflation of the previous couple of years, than a lot of other countries, especially the UK. The UK has notably not had as much infrastructure investment in recent years. Do you think there's a link between this sort of growth because of these policies and maybe less growth in other countries, or is it too early to tell, or aren't there potentially other factors in play here?
Sure. I think there's multiple factors. I think it's, you know, the boring answer is I think it's multifactorial, right? There's multiple things going on. And of course, the steps the UK took during post-COVID too. But I think you're on to something. I think it's generally right. I don't think these things hurt, at least. And I think the kind of Bidenomic package and these pillars, I would say probably contributed a bit. But of course, a lot of the other fiscal policies, which are surely part of what we usually think of as Bidenomics, and macroeconomic policies, which were pretty smart, played a role. But I'm very curious of that myself. I think it's an open question, but I think at least it didn't hurt. I think it's safe to say it probably buoyed expectations a bit and did indeed help in some important ways. But some of that's to be seen. Some of that will be seen retrospectively. But I think there is something to that hunch. I think there is something to that.
Thank you. Looking now to the near future, if Donald Trump does win the White House this November, how might the industrial policy of his administration differ to those of Joe Biden?
That's the tough question. I know that in the back of a lot of people's minds with designing industrial policy in democracies, that you would hope that, again, industrial policies are long-term things, and you hope they survive the tumult of the political cycle and the political business cycle. And so I do know that that is front of mind with the architects of a lot of, again, Bidenomic industrial policy. It's tough because Trump has gone out of his way to say, hey, I'm going to, you know, he's stated he wants to retrench the IRA. And he lambasts Biden's economic policy broadly. And so, but if you see where a lot of these policies are landing in places like Ohio or Arizona or important swing states, and if you think about a lot of these policies were bipartisan, championed by people like Marco Rubio, Republicans who are, Marco Rubio was, before a couple of weeks ago, was in the running to be his vice president, So there is bipartisan consensus behind some of these. And moreover, I think it's politically hard to rip a lot of these things out. I think it would be deleterious. But when it comes to Trump, he does wacky stuff and uncertain stuff. But, does Donald Trump really want to rip out and decrease manufacturing jobs in a state like Arizona? I'd guess not. But then again, you don't know. But I think there's a weird contradiction in the Republican Party's vibes. With they want to pursue, and they kind of, people like J.D. Vance, who is the vice president candidate, he does articulate, and so does Trump, and Trump echoes this sometimes too, kind of an idea of conservative populism, appealing to manufacturing, appealing to kind of trying to restore American manufacturing to its good old days, and trying to speak to good jobs in backward places, et cetera, et cetera. So there are motions at doing that, and they are kind of sometimes articulating, at least broadly, those types of ideas, which one would think, well, industrial policy is compatible with those things. But the weird contradiction with them is that they also want to, old Biden officials said, deconstruct the administrative state. So while they have the impulse to pursue kind of Republican economic nationalism, they also want to, and have kind of made provocations at dismantling the bodies that we just talked about that actually pursue this stuff and should be kind of empowered to pursue this stuff well. And so there's a weird tension and weird incoherence in their policy plans and policy visions. People talk a lot about Project 22, this document that is kind of put forth as a Trump administration vision for a Trump presidency, a second Trump presidency. And this thing really does articulate dismantling the administrative state, politicizing. And this, I don't mean this in a pejorative way. I mean this in kind of a descriptive way, an empirical way. It's like these people are saying, we want to politicize various arms of the federal government. And a lot of that is, I think, deeply troubling when it comes to a history of industrial policy. That's where industrial policy can go wrong, when you want to fire or let go of entire bodies of the U.S. government, which, again, some of this makes motions to do. That's stuff that seems very, very incompatible with pursuing industrial policy coherently and in a good way. And there you might wonder, will the Trump administration pursue some kind of weird, politicized, discordant industrial policy, using the kind of, using what was left of Bidenomics if he comes to power?
As we record this podcast at the very end of July 2024, It looks like Vice President Kamala Harris will win the Democratic nomination for president. If she wins the election this year, does this signify any change to the approach that the U.S. will take towards industrial policy?
It's tough. That's the question. That's kind of the tea leaves we're all trying to read right now. But I would say, I think it's fair to say, I think there's going to be a lot of continuity when it comes to industrial policy under a potential Harris administration. She's been a champion of these very policies we've talked about. She's been vocal for her, you know, she will want to kind of, I think, anchor herself to Biden's economic legacy, which I think is will be seen retrospectively as pretty good and is kind of definitely recently being seen more positively. And so I think those are things that there will be continuity with. And I think some of the people in her orbit are people who are wonks who are into industrial policy. And those we would think of as people who will be parts of Harris administration. There are questions as to whether, I should say, an important part of Biden's kind of, again, what we think of as Bidenomics has been his emphasis on promoting competition and trying to develop a rather robust, empowered competition authority within the U.S. And there are some worries as to whether that component of Bidenomics, which is an important, I think, underlying component of doing industrial policy well, will be as robust under a Harris administration. Some big Democratic donors who come from tech aren't big fans of Lina Khan, who is the kind of the head of the Federal Trade Commission and a big proponent of reigning in monopoly power. One worries whether she will stay, because surely some big Democratic donors do not want her to stay. And so I think there's an open question as to how prolific some of the anti-monopoly stuff will be under Harris. But I think more or less we would see a continuation of Bidenomics under Harris if we kind of look at the evidence in front of us right now.
That's the end of my substantive questions. But just before we finish, I just wanted to give you an opportunity. If there's anything you wanted to direct our listeners to, new work from you yourself or articles, books, or anything like that.
Sure. My co-PI, my fellow co-founder, Rekha Juhas, who is at the University of British Columbia, her and I have a steady stream of papers and research coming out with amazing co-authors. That is all being conducted by our lab, the Industrial Policy Group. So check out the Industrial Policy Group or industrialpolicygroup.com for that. And beyond that, it really, that's kind of, I think, where you want to go if you have information or if you want information about our own research and kind of our own portfolio of stuff, which is very much front of center in this area. I would check out work from Danny Roderick, who's a collaborator and colleague over at Harvard Kennedy School, who is producing very, very interesting stuff on industrial policy with a team of people with Rethinking the Economy Initiative over there. That's a great, amazing resource right now. And I'm sure there's many others I'm forgetting too. But those check out our work at industrialpolicygroup.com. I'm on Twitter, always rambling about industrial policy at my X account, at Straight Edge.
Thank you so much for that. And we'll link to those in our show notes as well.
Sure. Thank you.
Just remains for me to say thank you so much for speaking to the Ballpark this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great. And these were great questions.
Nathan Lane is Associate Professor in Economics at Oxford University and a Tutorial Fellow in Merton College, Oxford. And that's it for this episode of the Ballpark. Thanks so much to Professor Nathan Lane for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan U.S. Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/United-States. On Twitter and Instagram, we're at @LSE_US, and on Facebook and LinkedIn, we're LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Anderson Tan. Our theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and unlike lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. You can email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at @LSE_US. And tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan US Centre or the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.